We are obsessed with true crime. We're obsessed with wrongful convictions and podcasts. And my next guest is an expert. He is Gilbert King. He's the author of, among other books, The Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys. He won the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for that book. I'm just starting that. It's excellent already. He's also written about Supreme Court history, the death penalty. He's a contributor to the New York Times, Washington Post, and the Smithsonian Magazine. But the latest is this narrative podcast called Bone Valley, and which I just started as well. I want to talk to him a little bit about that and his career. Gilbert King, thank you so much for joining me on the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, Karen. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Let's first start talking about what can you do with a podcast that you can't do with a book, and what can you do with a book that you really can't do with a podcast? Since you're so good with both of these mediums, or media, I guess you should say, what is your angle on both of them?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because I really had to learn podcasting. I was coming from the world of books for a while, and I wasn't really sure I would be very, interested in this at all. But one of the things I found was just like the intimacy of putting on some headphones and just being like absorbed in this world, and you can hear the voices, and it's just a much more intimate format. And because I'm used to writing books, history books, where, everybody involved is dead, I don't really get that opportunity to hear. But in this particular case, most of the people were still alive. And, interviewing them and having a microphone really close to them and then putting on the headphones and hearing it, you can hear the voices crack, the emotion. And that was just something that was really new to me. And I really have enjoyed it since then. You know, the opposite side of it, the advantage to writing books sometimes is that you don't have to rely on the tape. You know, you can maybe sometimes there's no audio from a trial, but I can still recreate those scenes, on the page with the writing. And that's something that, really you can't really do with a podcast, where you just end up reading transcripts. So they both have advantages and disadvantages, but I'm really starting to really like the podcasting format.
You know, I am too, and having done radio, live radio, for 30 years here in Chicago, it's a whole different thing than even live radio. Live radio is boom, 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 and you've got to be quick, and people are doing other things like driving the car and cooking their dinner. So you can't do the same things you do with a podcast, which, is lengthy, and like you say, you're following it, you're listening to it, you're giving your attention to it. And radio, on the live radio, it's a little bit different format.
Yeah, you're really right about that. I mean, sometimes with the podcast, you can really slow it down, and the silences can mean something.
Sure.
I'm imagining in live radio, you don't want a lot of silence.
No, you actually don't. Well, before we get into the podcast Bone Valley, and I've got a little clip that I want to play for our listeners, what do you think of this idea of solving crimes? I mean, podcasters are getting people interested in cases. Do you think that this is really a good thing for people who have wrongful convictions? Do you think this is the way maybe crimes are going to be solved?
Well, I mean, it really shouldn't be, right? Like, you would like to think that the police can handle this and not a bunch of, like,
right, amateurs,
like,
right,
out there trying to solve things with no experience. But, I'm very selective about the cases I look into. I really spend a lot of time with them. I don't have these really tight deadlines. So, like my books sometimes usually take me 5 years. That was the same thing with this podcast. It literally took me 4 or 5 years to get this thing off the ground with all the investigation and the interviews. I think for me, I'm very selective about it, and I don't want to go in there and find out 2 years into it, like, wow, I got this completely wrong. So before I really even start making the podcast, I want to make sure I have my facts right, and I feel really confident on the ground that I'm walking in. And so I think it can be a really good thing if you can devote the time and the patience to looking into these cases. But I could see some problems if you try to rush something out there.
And, you have to have the respect of the people you're dealing with. Now, going back into a case where there's a conviction that you might believe is wrongful, I mean, you're talking to prosecutors, you're talking to defense lawyers, you're talking to inmates, you're talking to so many people, and you have to get their trust. How is it, and it sounds like you've done a really good job of that, how is it that you garner the trust of the people you're dealing with, who probably have been through a lot of issues and maybe don't want to have this overturned because it's going to make everyone look bad?
I mean, I think, like, with the case of, like, the Bone Valley case with Leo Schofield, I mean, he was in prison. He's been there for 30 years, and I don't think he had any more hope left. I mean, he had all his legal evidence had been exhausted. So if somebody comes along and sort of says, I want to go in and re-examine this case, you know, I'm sure he was skeptical about it and then probably didn't make him feel very great when I said, I might need 5 years.
Right.
Can you wait there? You know, like, what? That's a hard thing to ask. But, you know, I think what helped me a lot was I stayed in Florida where my books take place. And, people sort of down there knew me a little bit better. And they knew that I'd written a book about this old case from 1949 that actually the book came out. And then it ultimately exonerated them because I found all this new evidence in the FBI files and everything. So that gave me a lot of credibility within the state of Florida. And I think it helped get, people start looking into me. They could see like, oh, he really is going to put the work in. So that was definitely what helped.
Absolutely. We're talking to Gilbert King. He's the author of, among other books, the Pulitzer Prize winning book, Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys. And he is the host and producer of Bone Valley. And when we come back, before we start our interview, I'm going to play a little clip that kind of sets the tone for what this podcast is about.
I just want justice for my dead wife. That's what I want. Because you're never going to give me justice. Never. You can't give me back 34 years. You can't give Michelle back her life. But the least you can do when you say that you care about her is do the right thing by her. Just do what's right. Do what's right. Because this is not it. This is definitely not it.
That was the voice of Leo Schofield, a man who served 36 years in prison for murdering his 18-year-old wife, a crime he did not commit. Gilbert King is the host and producer of the podcast Bone Valley. Let's talk about how you got involved in this case. A very interesting story, Gilbert.
Yeah, I mean, it's like nothing I've ever really experienced before. I was speaking at a judicial conference down in Florida. And at the end of the conference, after I spoke, I was signing books for a lot of the judges down there. And this one judge approached me, Judge Scott Cupp, circuit judge down there, and handed me his business card. And on the back of his business card, I looked at it and it said, Leo Schofield, not just wrongfully convicted, he's an innocent man. And I remember, like, he's just motioned, like, to call him. And I asked some defense attorneys that I was having dinner with that night, and I said, what do you think about this? Judge just handed me this. And they were, like, stunned. They said, there's ethical canons here. You're not supposed to just be criticizing the criminal justice system as a sitting judge. And they passed the card around the table. They were all commenting on it. The last one was from that county. And he said to me, I know that case. You should call him. And that was sort of what inspired me. Like, I got to call this guy back. And once I started talking to him, he said, like, look, they railroaded this guy. I'll tell you exactly how they did it. And he was very angry about it. Everything sort of checked out exactly the way he told me it did.
So interesting. Now, this judge who gave you his card, was he involved with the case or did he just know tangentially about it?
No, he was involved like something like 15 years earlier, and then he got nominated to the bench, and he just had to leave Leo behind. And, he was just in this moral conundrum, like, what do I do? Like, I have to step away to become a judge, but I don't want to leave Leo. Like, he believed in his innocence, and he just, kept losing in court. And at that point, Leo told him, look, you have to take this card. If you don't take this judgeship, I won't talk to you again. And Leo put a lot of pressure on Judge Cupp. And he was sitting around for years, not sure what to do. And then finally he said, I got to get help. I got to find someone to hear this story. And that's what he set out to do.
So let's talk a little bit about who is Leo Schofield. Tell me about the crime that was committed and how he was convicted of this crime.
Yeah, well, this is, he's like this New England kid. He's got this thick Boston accent, and he's like 19 years old, and he moves down to Florida with his family, and, he's a heavy metal guitarist, and, he just feels like a fish out of water with all these southern Floridians around there, and drops out of school and just gets involved with this band and meets a girl, and, they start dating. Very quickly, they get married, and 6 months into their marriage, Michelle, who's 18 at the time, just goes missing, and they can't find her. And 3 days later, they find her within the same neighborhood. She's floating face down in an abandoned phosphate pit. And, the authorities didn't really know what to do with it because Leo had been searching, calling police constantly. His behavior didn't tip anything off, and he was the one, initiating these searches. But they couldn't solve it for like a year and a half. And then finally they just, started asking around the neighborhood, and the neighbors were like, well, they used to fight a lot. And basically just kind of settled on, we have to solve this crime, and they settled on Leo as the main suspect. And, you know, I think it's like one of these wrongful convictions where, you know, you have poor people who don't have a lot of money, they can't really defend themselves, and they get some bad lawyering, and it was kind of a perfect storm for Leo. Just all sorts of mistaken witnesses that were seeing the wrong things and just some bad lawyering, and next thing you know, he's convicted, exhausts all these appeals, and he spends 30 years in prison. Hard to imagine it happening like that, but that's exactly how it happened.
Gilbert, before we talk a little bit more about the details of this, I just want to remind our listeners, Bone Valley is the name of the podcast. Gilbert King is the host and producer. Really, really well done and highly acclaimed. Just generally speaking, when you see, you know, you deal with wrongful convictions, you've dealt with the death penalty, you deal with these issues, and I think all of us have listened to a podcast or watched a show about a wrongful conviction. What are the elements that you see that go into the idea that somebody is wrongfully convicted? I mean, you mentioned bad lawyering, but if you could just maybe bullet point those things that you think really lead to these wrongful convictions, because I will say this as a lawyer for 40 years, people say, you know what, he probably did it. And if he didn't do it, he did something else, because otherwise you wouldn't be sitting in jail. People just don't get it that the system fails people regularly.
Yeah, I mean, it's really shocking. And the people who are like most surprised by it are usually the people who get accused of this, because they've been cooperating. They've been taught, like, just tell the police the truth and everything's going to work out fine. You have nothing to hide. And that's often not the case. And, you know, I think it's a combination. Sometimes you have just bad policing. It's just like, well, this guy, we know he's a bad guy. We know he's done other things. He probably did this too. And then they just settle down this path where everything is sort of tunnel vision. You're moving towards the conviction. And prosecutors can be guilty of this too. I think you see a lot of that kind of stuff, like this tunnel vision. I think you see a lot of bad defense lawyering. And, you know, honestly, like, in Leo's case, he would have been better off staying with the public defenders. The public defenders in this part of Florida were great, but he ended up going with this kind of Better Call Saul kind of lawyer, who's, you know, 50, one of those kind of guys.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, he's like, I'm not an evidence guy. Like, I'm just up there. I do trial by ambush. I don't do a. He didn't do any, like, depositions of witnesses, no investigation. He just kind of winged it. And it really hurt Leo a lot, because he was up against a really aggressive prosecutor. And then sometimes you see, like, just a witness who's been maybe manipulated by the police, like, told, like, look, we need your help to get this guy off the streets. He's a bad guy. And didn't you see him fighting a lot? Didn't you see this? And they put thoughts into the witness's heads. And that's what you saw in this case. The witness, you know, even 20 years later, she was still changing her story. And Leo kind of had a perfect storm of a lot of different factors. But those are the main ones I see the most.
Yeah. And, you know, and I would maybe add to that sometimes media attention, because, you know, when the media wants to find the murderer, you know, of this 18-year-old girl found face down in a pit, you know, there's a public outcry. And they're, you know, even if they have the best intentions in the world, they are in a hurry to solve these crimes, because they've you know, it there's a lot of pressure. And I think you're absolutely right, Gilbert. And for all our listeners out there who have ever been accused of a crime or will be accused of a crime, you're so much better off with public defenders than a bad lawyer. Your first thing is to get your F. Lee Baileys or your Johnny Cochran's of the world. But if you can't afford that, you're probably better off with a public defender, because here in Cook County, you know, we do have really good public defenders. So tell me how you approached this whole thing. I assume that speaking to Leo in the prison was the first order of business, because he probably had some suspicions who might have killed Michelle.
Yeah, I mean, this is the strangeness of this case and why I was really interested in it. So 17 years into Leo's prison sentence, these unidentified fingerprints that were found in the car that his wife was driving, they hadn't been identified, because they didn't have an APHIS system that you could run them through back in the 80s. And so they just kind of sat there unidentified. They didn't match Leo. They didn't match his wife. They didn't know whose they were. In 17 years, they re-ran them, and they matched a killer, a man who's been in prison for killing someone in the same neighborhood, basically, and an extraordinarily violent young man who was sitting in a prison for another murder nearby. And so that set off alarm bells, because it wasn't the tow truck driver. It wasn't one of the, you know, detectives or the officers on the scene, a crime scene guy. It was an actual killer who lived nearby. And then, you know, by the time I started looking into it, this man had ultimately confessed. He said, I'm the one that did this. Leo does not belong in prison. I'm living with all this guilt. And, you know, I ended up talking to him in prison, the actual killer himself, and he told the story like that nobody else but the killer would know. Like, he knew all the details. He remembered the night. He described it perfectly. And so this is a strange situation where, like, Leo's always maintained his innocence, even after being offered these plea deals. He said, nope, I'm not telling you. I can't. I got to go with the what happened. I had nothing to do with this. I'm not taking a plea deal. And they didn't believe Jeremy Scott, the actual killer, because initially he denied it. And so they said he's got no credibility. And so here you have these two men who, like, have sort of settled on the truth between each other, and the state of Florida doesn't believe either guy. That's what really interested me in this case.
Well, at some point, there are few mechanisms that the law allows to reopen these things. You know, there are the time deadlines. There are only a finite number of appeals. And when you find yourself in that situation where you know the truth, but you don't know how to procedurally go about it, you know, you have to rely on kind of unusual and creative tools, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the thing that was really created the real interest for me, because I like to look into cases where, you know, the power is maybe at fault here. And you had a prosecutor, the same man who put Leo in prison in 1987. He also put the real killer in for the murder that he got convicted of like a year and a half later. So now he's in charge of doing the investigation into a case that he could end up overturning one of his earlier convictions. And so he doesn't really want to investigate this. He kind of slams the investigation shut, like, really quickly. And just nothing to see here, folks. And then you're like, wow, what's this guy doing here? Like, why is he the one that should be investigating this? He's the prosecutor in both cases. And so that really set off alarm bells to me.
Gilbert King, we didn't have enough time, but I encourage everyone to listen to Bone Valley. We have a few seconds left, but I think you have a second season, and you deal with the issue of the actual killer in your second season. Is that right? You've got about 10 seconds here.
It is, yeah. We went back into the family and went into Jeremy again and talked to him, and you know, he ended up confessing to another murder that he committed that he didn't get caught on. So that's part of the second season.
Fascinating. Gilbert King, thank you so much for joining us.